is, can you hear me okay with the mic? Perfect. Now, since I attend Willington, some of you who know me, like there are some people here, like my friend Dr. Haight, Aaron, Rick, Helmut, who's the head of the ushering team, who think, that's Rick? That's probably not true. there's quite a lot of skeptical people here when they heard that bio. So, anyways, some of it's actually true, but one important part was left out of the introduction. And this relates to my friend Helmut over here. Helmut, can you just stand for a sec? This is Helmut Taves. You can stand. Nothing will happen to you. Don't have to answer a question. Oh, Penner. I'm going to get myself fired. Helmut Penner. You know what his position is? You know what his position is? He's head usher.
Assistant.
You know the ushering team at Willington? It's so big, we have a manual, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have a manual to learn how to usher. And we always need lots of ushers, but they're really, really hard to find. So fortunately, I slipped in there. So I'm actually part of the ushering team. Now, who in here thinks ushering is easy? Oh, no?
I'm one of the ushers too.
Edwin, right? Can you just stand up? Here's a fellow member of the ushering team. It's not easy, is it?
No.
Have you ever made a mistake?
Yes.
Which mistake have you made?
Assumptions.
Assumptions?
Yes.
About what?
That people know where they're going or people know where they are.
This is a perfect tie-in for this session on calling, because people don't know where they're going. Exactly. Thank you. You know some of the mistakes I've made ushering? You know, we have a name tag. You're supposed to leave the name tag here. I actually walked out with the name tag. Exactly. You know, those name tags are expensive. You know, the other thing is, we actually have to count the people in our section. If you don't count, Helmut gets really mad at you. That's another thing. You know when those... I mean, look at this guy. I mean, look how big he is. I mean, you don't want to get Helmut mad at you. You know, the other thing is, do you think it's easy collecting the money? Who laughed? I heard a laugh over here. Do you know how complicated it is? You know, I've got two baskets. My partner on the other side has got two baskets. How many baskets is that? Ray was not going to answer. He thought it was a trick question. Okay, there's four baskets. Do you think it's ever happened where I went down the aisle, okay, there's two over there, there's two over here, and then as you're going up, you lose track of a basket? Edwin, has that ever happened to you?
You end up with five.
Yeah, you end up with more baskets. That's good. That's like multiplying the loaves and fishes, right? See, usually what happens is, like one time, I had the two baskets there, the two baskets here, I got to the back of the church, and then this guy is down the front row, and he's waving this basket, and he's chasing me down. So I lost track of the baskets. Now, the worst thing that can happen is, ushers have to be trustworthy, right? Because we handle the money, right? So those baskets have money in it. So what happened was, we take the benevolent offering once a month. So I had the money from the benevolent offering. And then what happens is, you might have guessed, I'm a little talkative. So you know how long the distance is from where I stand in my ushering position to where the usher's room is? It's like 50 to 75 feet. So what happened one time is, I had my benevolent offering here, and I start to walk into the foyer. So, of course, I start talking to people, probably people like Rick and Aaron, distracting me from my task. So all of a sudden, I'm in the foyer with the money. I don't know if it was Helmut or somebody else. Of course, they're in the usher room thinking, where's the money? So it's not really good as an usher if you can't be trusted with the money. So one of the challenges is that when you're ushering, you got the money, you got to bring it right back there. So that's an important part of my bio, is the ushering. All right. Secondly, anybody recognize that? No women put up your hand. Okay, Willington is very, very skilled at marketing. Now, do you think there's more men or women here? I think there's maybe more women here. I was thinking this might be too heavily weighted towards men because I was ushering and somebody comes up to me and says, hey, I saw a poster for the presentation. I go, hey, great, where was it? It was right above the urinal. He goes, somehow that seemed appropriate. So, you know, I'm not going to draw too many conclusions from it, but for all you women who presumably don't go into the men's washroom too often, that's how the marketing happens at Willington. So, all right. So that's a little bit of warm-up, because I know it's Saturday morning, and, you know, you had some coffee, hopefully you had some muffins, got your energy going a little bit. What we'll talk about today is, to me, one of the most important concepts for Christians. I think it's an absolutely core concept for every Christian. What I want to drive home today in the time we have is to emphasize that if you're not clear on your calling, you are not living as an effective life as you otherwise would be. So if you ask yourself right now, could I state what my calling is? If you can't, then I believe you are not living as fulfilled a life as you otherwise should be. So that's something you have to answer for yourself. Do I have the clarity of calling? A simple way to judge that is, if somebody asks you to do something with your time, talent, or treasure, can you give an instant response? If not, I don't think you have clarity of calling, and I don't think you're living as effective a life as you otherwise would be. Because I find if you have clarity of calling, you already thought out what your calling's about, how you'll apply your time, talent, and treasure, and you can give an automatic response. So for me, there's lots of things I'll say no to instantly, and there's other things I'll say yes to before the person even finishes asking the question. So that's what we want to drive towards, to have all of you leave with a clear sense of calling. Now, Norm alluded to the format this morning. I'll talk until around 10:15. We'll take 10-15 minute break, and then we're going to have some group work at the tables. We have a calling action plan worksheet, so you'll work at that at your table. And then after we've done that, then we'll have the different tables report to the whole group to discuss their view of calling and some of the things they've discovered. So that's the format for this morning. Now, it's quite interesting because you might think of, you know, calling. Well, is that a Christian concept that's not that common in our society? Or do people really think or talk about this? Well, think of calling from the standpoint that calling for a lot of non-Christian people would be the same as purpose, the pursuit of meaning. And it's quite fascinating that virtually everybody you meet will have this notion of, there must be some meaning to my life. Whether they're believers or not, virtually everybody will think, my life must have some meaning. There's not many people you'll meet who will say, I'm entirely content living a meaningless life. My life has no meaning. I'm perfectly happy with that. Very, very few people will think that way. Now, it's quite interesting in secular thinking how people conceive of meaning. Now, there's a really interesting fellow named Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl was a person who survived the horrors of the Nazi concentration camps in World War II. And as he endured that experience in the camps, and he was one of the few people to survive and be freed by the Allies and then develop an actual approach to psychology called Logos Therapy. So what he discovered is that the people who survived the camps were not the strongest or the fittest, but they were the people who had something to live for beyond themselves. Now, you look at this quote, man's search, and this book is an absolute classic. It's a very short book, well worth reading. Man's search for meaning is his primary motivation in life. This meaning is unique and specific in that it must and can only be fulfilled by him alone. That's in a sense a great secular affirmation or explanation of Christian calling. Because what we'll talk about in terms of calling is that each one of you in here is called by God to something unique and specific that you alone can do. And I believe that if you don't do that, it will go unfulfilled for eternity. Now that seems like a heavy burden for a Saturday morning. But the reality is, it's true that each one of us has a unique and specific calling that can only be fulfilled by us alone. And if that's not fulfilled, it will go unfulfilled for eternity. So that's what we have to search for. So that's the perspective of Viktor Frankl. Now, there's another interesting concept in our society. Sometimes people say, well, I don't really need to have a meaningful life. I just want to be happy. Isn't that great? It's only seemingly in the Western world where we can be so superficial that we can just go through life saying, I just want to be happy. I don't want stress at work. I don't want stress anywhere. I want everything to just go, get a job, have a nice and comfortable. I just want to be happy. So that's, you know, it's quite interesting. If you watch, you know, if you have the misfortune of watching too much TV and flipping channels, you think, there's so much superficiality. I mean, that's really what people are about. I just want to be happy. So it's quite interesting. This psychologist, John Schumacher, and this is a really great book. he talks about this whole notion of the search for happiness. The quest for happiness has become nothing short of a cultural obsession. The concept of happiness has become so hallowed that it's beginning to resemble a cult or religious surrogate. So it's really interesting in our society, often the things that a Christian worldview competes with is not other religious worldviews, but rather other trends within our society, such as the quest for happiness. I just want to be happy. You know what's really fascinating? When you read this book, it's about a 350-page book. At the end of the book, what he concludes is the way people find happiness, again, it's really interesting how a lot of external sources end up confirming a Christian worldview. He says to be happy, after 350 pages of this entire book, he says to be happy, you have to engage in the service of others and to be involved in something greater than yourself. Doesn't that sound sort of Christian? You have to serve others and be involved in something bigger than yourself. That's what he concludes. He's not a Christian. That's what he concludes. Now, another person that I'll just give this perspective, Lord Stephen Green is a really fascinating individual. He's the former chairman and CEO of HSBC, Hong Kong Bank. So we lived in Hong Kong for a number of years, and HSBC is like the king of the hill in Hong Kong. They do 80 billion. So when his name is Stephen Green, Lord Green, I got to know him recently. He was a speaker at one of our conferences in Toronto. Unique individual. He had 300,000 employees, 80 billion in revenue. His last year, they netted 20 billion. He was a chairman and CEO. He's also an ordained Anglican priest. So he calls it a non-stipendary minister. So like a lay minister. And he's also an author. Really learned individual. Like when he speaks, it's like listening to The Economist. If you ever read The Economist, he speaks like he's reading right out of The Economist. Neither money nor ambition nor serendipity is good enough as a work-life principle. We have to find a better answer. Why do I do what I do? The matter answers, we only have one life. So you know there's all these cliches. Life is not a dress rehearsal. You know, you get one chance. Well, that's your life. So when you look at your calling, wouldn't you want to pursue calling and find out what God has in store for you and pursue that calling to make your life count? You know, you don't get a second chance. It's not a dress rehearsal. So really great way of stating it. So here's what we'll cover today. Normally when I do these presentations, I don't have as much detail. So I'll scoot over some of the details, but I wanted to have the PowerPoint be a little more comprehensive so that the PowerPoint has information that you can look at afterwards. So that PowerPoint will be available on our website and I can show you the link afterwards. So if some of this is too much detail, just skip it over and you can look at the PowerPoint later. But here's the outline of what we'll do. So we'll look at how people approach work, meaning at work. There's a traditional approach and what I call a secular approach. So we're talking about calling, but I'm looking at calling in the context of, you know, meaning at work. So not just calling generally, but how does our Christian view of calling impact how we approach the marketplace? So that's what we're going to look at. So first, meaning at work, traditional and secular approaches. Then next, a Christian approach. And this is a very significant point, because if you're not clear on the difference between a traditional, secular, and Christian approach, you'll get sucked in to the secular approach without even knowing it. Absolutely. So you have to have a very clear idea so what a Christian approach is. Now, how you live out your Christian approach, to me, is tied into the core concept of calling. So Christian approach, finding your calling, and then we'll have the three P's of calling. You know, many sermons have the three this, the three that. So I've tried to do this intentionally. So it's the three P's. But the good thing is, since it's a Saturday morning and we have a bit more time, I have a bonus P. I actually have four. So there's actually three plus the bonus. And then we'll talk about making a difference. All right. So let's look first at the traditional approach. Now, the reason I call this a traditional approach is I would say this was the standard or traditional approach to work probably up until about the late 1970s. So the traditional approach means that we have one circle over here, which is work. And at work, I do a good job. I build up my skills. I find it meaningful. I find it important, but not ultimately significant. I just do a good job. I have skills and it's important and it's good, but it doesn't fulfill ultimate meaning. I don't look for it to fulfill ultimate meaning. My work is not tied to my meaning in life. I'm just doing a good job, that's it. Because that's work. And then over here, we have meaning. So where do I look for meaning? Well, there's religious institutions which provide that meaning. Meaning there's churches, there's synagogues, there's temples, there's places that are basically set up to say, we provide meaning in life. So the traditional approach is very clear difference between the two. I go to work, I have a good career, I make good money, that's it. But I'm not looking to you for meaning in life. Meaning in life is over here. That's where I go, let's say Sunday or Saturday, whatever. I do that separately. So that's what I'd call the traditional approach. Now, it's interesting. Here's this guy, Peter Drucker, who's the father of modern management. And he talked a lot about entrepreneurship. And he talked about entrepreneurship as, you know, it's just a systematic way of innovating, doing new, unique things that are creative, different. You focus on, you know, job well done. You pursue excellence. And it's important, but not ultimately significant. So that's the traditional approach to meaning and work. And in some ways, that's almost better for religious institutions. Because then when you're at work, you're not looking for meaning. No, we're the church. You come to us for meaning. Work doesn't deal with that at all. So we're very clear on that distinction. That's the traditional approach. But that changed, I'd say, starting in the 1980s. Now, why did it change? Well, there's a number of trends that have occurred in our society, which all lead to what I call self-crafted spirituality. So one of the first trends is what we call deinstitutionalization. So I realize that's a lot of syllables for a Saturday morning, but you can see what the word means, you know, institution, deinstitutionalization. So now what that means is people no longer view the institutions as the sole source of pursuing meaning in life. So how often have you heard things like, well, you know, church is good, but you know, I can do my own church. I can watch TV. I can have, just do things on my own. And I don't need the institution. I can watch TV. I can pursue meaning on my own. So the institutions no longer have that primary role. And, you know, the interesting thing is, and that ties into things like church membership too. You know, a generation or two ago, people thought, no, I have to be a member of a specific church and the membership's important. Whereas these days it affects things like, well, you know, I can flow from church to church. I don't really have to have an institutional commitment. And sort of, you know, what works for me is sort of okay. So the institutions are no longer the primary guardians of meaning in life. Now, secondly, relativism. You know, it's quite interesting. When I was at Bible school way back, there was books like Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. So here's the Christian approach, and I'm going to prove that you're wrong. So you take this, you know, you're Muslim or Jewish or whatever, I'm going to say, okay, this is the right way. We're talking about the truth. Whereas now the approach is very different. It's like, well, here's what I believe is the truth. The way most people respond, hey, good, good for you. Works for you, fill your boots, whatever. Because people don't think in terms of one specific truth. See, before, Christian apologetics was based around there's one truth, we're proving it's the one truth, in contrast to your version of truth. Whereas these days, people are more inclined to say, yeah, whatever, lots of ways to skin the cat. Yeah, whatever, sure, good for you. That's relativism. So that's become a bigger and bigger trend. Now, the third one is this human potential movement. Now, this is very prevalent in the business world. So the human potential movement always talks about how I can do everything on my own. I don't need anybody or anything else. All the power I need is the power within. You know, there's a Tony Robbins of the world, right? Awaken the giant within. Awaken all this stuff within. And we're not using as much of our potential as we should be. So I just use more of that and I can overcome everything. Well, those three trends together, and there's many other trends that I haven't referred to here but are in my book, it all leads to this self-crafted spirituality. So actually, I don't need institutions. Like, I can invent my own form of spirituality. I can invent my own form of meaning because it's all about me. It's the worship of myself. Now, it's quite fascinating, even with respect to the sense of calling. You might think, okay, calling, doesn't that imply there's a caller? Would that make sense? If we say you're called, there's a calling. you think there must be a caller. That's the Christian approach. God is the caller. The secular approach is, you know what? Calling is a great concept, but actually you can be self-called. It's an internally generated call. So the literature, when it comes to vocational psychology, like there's lots of books on, well, actually calling can be self-generated. It's the calling within. So it just feeds exactly into this trend where it's all about me. I can invent my own meaning in life. Now it's interesting. So this is the start of the secular approach. Now the reason this is very, very significant is that the traditional approach to work and meaning starts to break down. And remember how we showed work and meaning are completely separate. Now what happens with this secular approach, work and meaning start to blend together. So what happens is, you know, work takes up so much of your time. Institutions are no longer that important. So what happens is you start to find your meaning at work. Now just think, does this sound at all familiar that when you're at work, I mean, a lot of the leading companies out there, you can eat there, you can sleep there, you meet your mate there, you join teams there, and you identify with that company. And in our society, what happens? Usually when you meet somebody, you usually say, hey, so what do you do? Oh, I work at. So your identity actually becomes the company. So a lot of people identify with the company. So what happens is, now if you ask a lot of people, and you could ask yourself this question or think of people you know in your circle, what gives you meaning in life? If you lost your job tomorrow, will you still have meaning in life? If the answer is I wouldn't have much meaning, that's a big problem. Because for a Christian, work is part of your meaning in life. It's not your entire meaning in life. And if it becomes your entire meaning in life, that's a really big problem. Because how do, you know, it's really interesting. Management theory, how do companies get the most out of employees? To own their soul. Absolutely. Now, they may not say that, but that's the intent. We own your soul. Meaning that when a push comes to shove, work gets the priority. Because my career is way more important. I have my friends at work. My identity is at work. I feel good about what I do at work. People stroke me at work. I identify as, I work with this company, I got this position. Well, that then becomes your meaning in life. That's what management theory is about. How do you get the most out of people? Well, when their life depends upon that job and their identity's in that job. That's why a lot of people, when they retire, they lose their job. They're floating. They've lost all meaning in life. So from a Christian standpoint, work fits into your meaning in life. It is not your meaning in life. So the reason I have these circles is because then it's sort of easier to follow. So traditional approach, work and meaning separate. Spirituality approach, they come together. Now, some of you may think, I don't quite buy this. This is a real stretch. This is an exaggeration. You know, the old straw man approach. You know, exaggerate a position, then, you know, knock it down. No, not true. So in the book, I've got a 180-page answer to this. Here's one simple quote, and I'll tie it into the context of entrepreneurship. So I've done a lot of entrepreneurial things over the years, and I love reading these books on entrepreneurship because they're usually sort of exciting and, you know, they tell you all these stories. But what's really fascinating is one of the most popular books on entrepreneurship is by this fellow, Michael Gerber. So this fellow up here, Michael Gerber, The E-Myth. If you have any interest in entrepreneurship whatsoever, you've probably read this book. Millions of copies sold. It's literally at every bookstore, the most popular one out there. So I read all these books on entrepreneurship. And you know what? How do you become a successful entrepreneur? Well, it's quite interesting because I think I'm reading a book that takes a traditional approach. Here's entrepreneurial skills you could use, you could have, you could develop. But then in the middle of the book, he starts getting all spiritual on me. So this is just a basic entrepreneurial book. Well, how do you succeed? Before you can determine what your role in your business will be, you must ask yourself, what do I value most? What kind of life do I want? What do I want my life to look like? Who do I wish to be? Your primary aim is your answer to all these questions. So his basic model for success as an entrepreneur is find a business that you're passionate about, that your identity is tied up in, and that when your business succeeds, you will have meaning in life. That's the message of that book. So your meaning in life is tied to that business. That's why you're going to give it your all. You're going to persist. You're going to do everything you possibly can to make that business successful. That's the spirituality approach. Now, what's dangerous is you know, I've read all these books, and the reason I picked this one in particular is, you know, for years and years, I want to learn, you know, I want to keep learning, so I'm buying these books. I'm thinking, this is just like good technical stuff. Then I think, you know, I remember reading the book thinking, I should be ashamed I'm reading this book. Like, this is the exact opposite to what I believe. And I remember thinking, I look back at the cover, oh, this is a book on entrepreneurship. It's not a book on meaning in life. It's a book on entrepreneurship. But this is the message that comes through in the spirituality approach. And this is very, very common. So what's a Christian approach? So here's the circles. From a Christian approach, we have our meaning in life. Work fits into that. So you don't find meaning at work. You bring your meaning to work. Now, of course, you know, and my co-author, Paul Stevens, who's my friend who's at Regent College, who's the guru in this field, he says, you know, work itself has meaning, right? So don't get me wrong that work has no meaning. No, I'm just saying, when you think of how we approach it, we come with our sense of meaning in life. Work fits in. So we don't go to a job, we don't join a company thinking, wow, you're going to give me meaning in life. Now, it may not always be that explicit, but it's definitely implicit. In terms of the values, the culture, the things the company emphasizes. So, in terms of the Christian approach, now normally I wouldn't pop this slide up there, but since this is Willington School of the Bible, I'll just pop this up there and then you can look at it later if you want. I think it's really, really important to have a clear distinction between what I call the secular approach and the Christian approach. Because otherwise what's going to happen is you'll get sucked into that secular approach without even knowing it. You know, and isn't that the greatest enemy? It's always the enemy within, right? When they talk about battles, it's the enemy within which destabilizes the foe. Not the enemy that's so obvious you can see it. So this is really dangerous. So the secular approach, self-narrative, I'm in control. Christian approach is God narrative. It's interesting. Secular approach, horizontal laws. I can learn the laws of success. Christian approach, the vertical laws. Attributes versus virtues. In the business world, there's a lot of attributes I should acquire because it'll help me do business. But attributes are grafted on from without. Virtues flow from within. So there's lots of tradition on Christian virtues. Purpose and meaning through work is a secular approach. Christian approach, calling and meaning through a whole life offering. Work fits into that. Self-oriented niche, which is the secular approach, versus a communal gift. It's really interesting. Gifts in the Bible are always talked about in the context of the Christian community. Lastly, self-help versus divine help. Now, I have to seek repentance because, you know, I love these books. When you go to the bookstore, they're always in the self-help section. Does anybody go to the self-help section? Aaron? Yes? No? Oh. Oh, yes, over there. What's your name? What's your name? Jenny. So, what type of books do you like at the self-help section?
I like leadership.
Okay.
Leadership.
Yeah.
Great leadership.
Okay. So, you know, when you go to the self-help section, you get stuff on like leadership, all that good stuff. But you know what's funny? When you go there, it says self-help. And I always feel like such a loser when I go there because I think there's nobody to help you. You gotta help yourself. You know, like it's sad, like I go to this section, I sort of look around, make sure I don't, you know, see anybody I know, and look at these self-help books. Well, that's the secular approach, self-help versus divine help. Because the Christian approach is, you know, God provides the leading. You know, it's really interesting, in the secular approach, there's no room for divine intervention. In the Christian approach, there is. All right, so now that we have a bit of a context as to there's a traditional approach, work and meaning like this. Secular approach, work and meaning are overlapping. Then we look at the Christian approach. We have our approach to meaning. Work fits into that. Well, how do we actually practice that? So in order to understand how we can be effective in the marketplace, I want to focus on calling. What I've found is before we can talk about calling, we have to talk about what calling is not. Because there's so many misunderstandings as to what calling is. As Norm mentioned, I've interviewed over 300 Christian entrepreneurs all over the world, and one of the questions we ask is, are you called? Like, do you feel called? It's quite fascinating. It shows that there's a lot of confusion over what calling actually is. So here's a few things that typically come up in terms of what calling is not. So people think in terms of sacred, secular divide. And this actually seems to depend on your age. So some of the people we've interviewed, they're in their 70s and over, they'll say, pastor's called, missionary's called, I'm not called. That's what we call the sacred secular divide. Now, at this church, we don't believe that, and most evangelical Christians would not believe that. And this goes right back to Martin Luther in the 1500s. Martin Luther broke down that sacred secular divide. Because it used to be that in the Catholic Church, there was like the holy people, you know, the monks, the scribes. They're set aside to do the holy work. And then there's the rest of the people who are just in the trenches slogging away. And that the work has no meaning in and of itself. That's not a Christian approach. All of us are called. And Martin Luther made that point. He says, you know, the person washing the dishes, scrubbing the floors, anyone involved in work is doing meaningful, God-honoring work, contributing to the creation. So there's no sacred, secular divide. Everyone is called. Now, of course, pastors, church leaders have special responsibilities, of course. But in terms of calling, all of us are called. So each one of you sitting in here, each single person is called. So then you have to think, what is my calling? And that's what we'll do as we go through the exercises after my presentation. So one, sacred secular, there's no more divide. But it's just something that's embedded in our language in the Christian community. Secondly, one-time event. Now, some of you may think, well, you know, I was not hit by lightning. There was not some transformative event where, bingo, you know, God told me you're expected to do this. Okay, calling is typically not a one-time event, but a process. You engage in the process. It's like you wrestle with the process. You have to discern what your calling is. But it's your job to find that calling, and there's a clear way that we'll explain how you can do that. But the key thing is, it's not a one-time event. Thirdly, must be audible. So sometimes people think, well, if I'm called, I must hear the voice of God. You know, God telling me, okay, you do this. You enroll in that program at that university, and then you work for this firm, and okay, now I have some clarity. Now, of all the entrepreneurs we've interviewed, some people will say, I actually heard an audible voice, which I believe. So there are people who may have that experience. A lot of people will say, I had an affirmation, such a clear affirmation, that there was no doubt in my mind that was a path to go. And I think probably a lot of you in here would say, I can recount examples of that. I could give you examples from my own experience where things happened where it was so obvious that was a path to go. Not a shred of doubt. Fourth, calling is your job. Calling is not your job. Your calling is much bigger than that. Your job is part of what you do. It's not your identity. Your calling. So don't say, oh, I have a legal background. Well, okay, I'm a lawyer. That's my calling. Well, that's not your calling. Your calling is way bigger than that. If you're in business, no, your calling is way bigger than that. It's not your job. Fifthly, individual pursuit. This is quite fascinating. You know, this is why we have churches. This is why we have communities, because, you know, the community can help discern things. So on the one hand, we have to have our inner conviction and our inner leading, but at the same time, the church and the community can be quite valuable in terms of affirming callings. Like just simple examples. Often people who are gifted at something, they discount their own gifting because it comes to them easily. Has anybody ever experienced that? Like you'll go to somebody who sings well and you go like, wow, that's phenomenal. You go, well, okay. Well, you know, whatever. I'm thinking, you gotta be kidding. Like for us who have, you know, Doug, you know this, I have like zero musical ability. Maybe even less than zero. So then when I hear people at church sing, like I think of Heather, I go like, this is like an angel singing. And I've said to her something like, this is phenomenal. And she's like, well, yeah, like, okay, whatever. I'm thinking like, you know, so sometimes it takes people on the outside to say, you've got this phenomenal gift. But all of us, it's so interesting. We discount what we do easily. So for example, you know, I like to write. So I've written a number of books. You know, English is actually not my first language, believe it or not. Well, how do I write books? Like, I can literally visualize it in my head, and as fast as my fingers can go, I can write the book. But I always thought, well, it's so easy, like, it can't be valuable. Like, I thought, well, that must just, everybody can do that, I guess. So I can actually, like, visualize it in my head, And as fast as I can write it down, I can have the whole structure and write the whole thing down. And I thought, well, I guess everybody can do that. And I thought, well, then people say, hey, you can write well. They go, oh, well, whatever. Because anything you can do well, you always discount. So that's why the community is good to say, hey, you realize you've got a gift there. And especially when older people can say that to younger people. Because often when you're a little older, like one generation up, you can see in young people go like, you know what? Absolutely. Like, I taught at Trinity Western for a number of years. I taught one of my students, Chris. I admire him because when I was at Trinity, you know, I thought he might have gotten enough of me there, but he's here. So he's here for more punishment. But what happened is, so I taught business law. And it's quite interesting. When you're the professor, you actually have a better perspective on the students than probably the parents do. Because I would always say, I had 1,000 students during the time I was at Trinity. So I had students who would be in my business law class, and I'd say, 100%, absolutely, you should go to law school. 100%, not a shred of doubt in my mind. So, how could you say that? Because I know. Absolutely. 100%. There's other people I go, 100%, no. You know? And I tell you, one person didn't believe me. He spent 2 years, and he goes, you know what? It's not that easy to get into law school. I go, yeah, no kidding. You have to have good marks. So just to say, you know, the community, you know, marks are a useful thing. If you want to go to, I mean, you can always go to Australia or go everywhere else, but if you want to get into one of the top schools in Canada, you 1 out of 15 get in. You better be good. So often, somebody on the outside can pinpoint that. So doing things in community is really important. So let's look at calling. So there's a lot of, and I talked to Norm about this, in terms of the biblical basis for calling. On our website, there's a number of blog posts, the 50 top verses on calling. I mean, I've got about 10 blog posts on calling, and if you want to find them, the website is ontarioleaders.com. Check out the blog. There is so much biblical support for calling, it's almost like it doesn't need to be discussed, except for the fact that people often don't understand the notion of calling. So here's a few verses. Calling is at the core of our faith. We're called in one hope. God has called us heavenward. We're called to eternal life. We're called to his purpose. We're expected to be worthy of the calling. So in the Old Testament, we have the chosen people. In the New Testament, we have the called people. So calling is at the core of our faith. Now, it's quite fascinating. A simple way to understand calling is there's a general call and a specific call. So this is a really important concept. So general calling means the things that all believers are called to, as some of the verses I just alluded to. So all of us are called to serve, to live a holy life, to all these different gifts, to walk worthy of that calling. That's the general call for everyone. So everyone is called. But next, there's a specific call. The things that you are specifically gifted for that is part of your unique calling. So I'll look first at some of the general aspects of calling. So I've got the pages in the book where this information is listed. So general aspects of calling: belonging to God, being God-like people in behavior, doing God's work in the world, and experiencing life purpose. Now, personal aspects of calling, and we're leading up to this. So you may be thinking, well, how do I discern my calling? Well, we start off with passion, and I'll go over that in a bit more detail, but passion is at the core of your calling. Do you ever ask yourself, who wired you for that passion? So if you think, we're created in God's image. We're created as unique beings. And you have a passion. You think, where'd that passion come from? Do you ever ask yourself why you're wired a certain way? Do you ever ask yourself that? Like, why do you want to do certain things? And the great thing is, there's people with all sorts of skill sets and backgrounds. And so we have dentists, we have accountants, we have business people. And, you know, don't you a lot of times look at the other person and go, I can't believe you enjoy doing that. Like, I'm glad there's people like you out there who enjoy accounting, for example. Like, you really enjoy that? Like, good for you, because that would drive me crazy. But that's what makes the world go around, right? Like, there's all these people with different passions. So you have to discover your passion. Then your gifts and talents are what equip you to pursue your calling. So all of us have different gifts. We're uniquely gifted, and those gifts equip us to fulfill our calling. There's lots of references in the Bible to the fact that we're equipped to do things that we can succeed at. We have unique gifts that allow us to fulfill our calling. Now, some of you may say, well, but God can, you know, assist me in my weakness. Well, okay, that may be true, but, you know, if you're not good at physics, don't become a nuclear physicist and say, God will empower me. No, we're talking about, there's a difference between getting outside of your comfort zone and getting outside of your skill zone. Okay, stay in your skill zone, but get outside of your comfort zone. Right, so comfort zone means, okay, I'm good at this, I can keep stretching myself, pushing myself, but don't get outside your skill zone. You're equipped for certain things. Providential circumstances. If you think, are there ever instances in your life where things have come together to push you in a certain direction that you thought, you know, this is truly the hand of God? This otherwise never would have happened. So it's quite interesting. All of us, from a Christian standpoint, should be good self-reflectors. Part of my PhD was on self-reflective analysis. And you know what? Most people in business, like entrepreneurs, are very poor self-reflectors. They think, well, I succeed in this way too. I guess everybody else can. No, actually, the success wasn't just yourself. There's lots of general factors at work. So for people to be good self-reflectors, it's actually not that easy. But that's something that you should always think about. Reflect back on your own experiences and say, well, how did these things come together? Would I have expected that? Because it's quite interesting. I always think God plans in advance of our ability to understand. So God plans in advance of our ability to understand, which means I can look back at things that I did, which I think were completely disjointed and random. And then all of a sudden, years later, I find out that I'm actually equipped to do something I didn't think I'd end up doing. But because of that experience, I was actually equipped to do it. So there's providential circumstances, then direct leading of God, you know, where there's actually like an overwhelming sensation. You know, there's a famous case of John Wesley, right? The founder of Methodism, you know, when he was in Oxford and had that internal, you know, that sensation, that warming that he felt was a drive of the Holy Spirit. So people have, you know, over in history, we have lots of examples of that. All right, so finding your calling. Now, Bruce Waltke was at Regent College, and I find his few steps here quite interesting. So, in terms of pursuing your personal calling. Now, sometimes what happens is people think, okay, I'm sitting here, and I want to understand my calling. So, I'll just wait for God to, you know, sit underneath a coconut tree, the coconut will hit me on the head, and I'll go, bingo, it'll all become clear. That's not really the way it happens. So, here's a number of steps. Number one, read your Bible. So if you're unclear on calling, well, read your Bible. There's lots of good stuff in there on calling. That's an easy starting point. Secondly, develop a heart for God. Develop a sensitivity and spiritual maturity to actually pursue calling. Thirdly, seek wise counsel. Now, wise counsel and counsel that has your best interest at heart. Because often people outside can have a very clear idea as to what you might be good at. Fourthly, does this make sense? He has a great line in there. God gave us a brain. He expects us to use them. That sounds so obvious, but, you know, in my past in the Christian circles, like I've had, like I still remember when I was in my early 20s, there was a pastor who came to our church, and he was involved in a messy divorce, and then got remarried, got divorced again, and then got remarried. And he appeared to church saying like he thought he'd be really good at marriage counseling, because he had been through it and he knew what it was like. Okay, even though I was in my early 20s, I thought, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. You know, so sometimes we talk about like, you know, God gave you a brain, like, use it. Now, it sounds so obvious, but like, you know, because you hear some of these things, like you go, okay, this does not make any sense. Okay, so, you know, just always apply your intellect to this process. Then divine intervention, as we discussed earlier. All right, so I'll just quote a few people on calling, just so you have a bit of context. Do a lot of you know who Oz Guinness is? Have you? So maybe it's a few have heard that name. He's probably one of the best Christian speakers out there. He's a graduate of Oxford. He teaches the Rabbi Zacharias Institute in Oxford. He's a phenomenal speaker and apologist. And this book on calling is probably one of the, I think it's probably the best book on calling out there. He talks about calling, a purposeful journey. It puts you on a purposeful journey. He distinguishes between calling and vocation. As I said, calling is much bigger than your job. And lastly, it's in God's hands. You know, I have to give the example of my dear wife, who's a social worker at Richmond General Hospital, dealing in oncology and palliative care. You know what happens when people face death? You know, when the doctor comes in and says, you've got 3 months, the doctor walks out, Brenda walks in. It's really fascinating how so many people, they want to fight it. They deny it. Can you believe it? There's families who say, okay, you tell the parents that their kid is dying. They don't want to tell their kid. Or sometimes the kids are told your mother or father is going to die of cancer in 3 months. They don't want to tell the parents. So this idea of actually dealing with it, grappling with it, people want to avoid it. And you know what gets people really upset? I hadn't planned on this. I had not planned on this. Because in our society, what happens? I am in control. That's a big mantra in our society. I am in control. And if I'm sick, I'm going to fight it. Well, the reality is, okay, some people can fight certain things, and there are experimental drugs. But you know what? When an oncologist with 30 years experience says, you got 3 months, you probably have 3 months. But what comes through so clearly when she recounts these stories to me is that people want to deny it. And what's at the bottom of it is, I did not plan on this. So from a Christian standpoint, you know how in the good old days people would say, okay, God willing. See you next, you know, I'll meet you for coffee next week, God willing. Nobody talks like that anymore these days. But we should. We should all this thing. Like everything we do in our calling is subject to divine intervention. So we have to live within the bookends of our life. And we know our days are numbered. So we don't know what day that will be. But what it should do then, from a calling standpoint, what it does for me is, that should be a major motivation. So anything that's important, you should do today. If you want to make a difference today. Don't put it off. Like, don't put it off for when I have more time, when I'm more prepared. No, do it now. You know, there's all these cliches like, every day is a mini life. How do you lead an impactful life? Have an impactful day. Have an impactful week. Have an impactful month and start right now. So that any time your time is up, you go, you know what? I've lived my life according to my calling and I've been given X number of days. That's it. Why should we demand more days? We're all on different journeys and calling is subjective. It's your calling, not somebody else's calling. Some people live to 100, some people live to 15. We don't know how many days we've got. So that should be a big motivation. So everything we do is subject to, it's in God's hands. Now here's a great, great quote by Oz Guinness. So calling is a truth that God calls us to himself so decisively that everything we are, everything we do, everything we have is invested with a special devotion and dynamism lived out in response to his summons and service. So hopefully after today you get start to think about calling. And I'd say use calling as a filter for making decisions. So I'm a bit extreme, but I have daily goals, weekly goals, monthly, quarterly, annual. I review it every year. And I'm always trying to focus on what's the highest and best use of my time in light of my calling. And I think that's something that we should all think about. How can we be a faithful steward of our time, talent, and resources to have the greatest impact? Now, I'm going to go through the three P's. Passion, purpose, priorities, and then the bonus one. Now, here's just some practical stories. Now, Mark Burnett is a fascinating story. Does anybody know, before I put up that slide, does anybody know who Mark Burnett is? So a few. So he's the guy behind Survivor, Celebrity Apprentice, Shark Tank, The Voice. So I don't know if they still are, but when we had him up to Vancouver, 2013, he was our keynote speaker. He had the number one show on TV, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And it's interesting, he grew up in London in a sort of a nominal Christian family. And then rediscovered his faith a number of years ago when he met Roma Downey. Some of you may know Roma Downey, Touched by an Angel, so that's the actress. So he married Roma Downey. It was really fascinating because he has such a passion for getting the message out, like a faith-based message out. So he's the guy behind, I don't know if you remember the Bible miniseries a few years ago. So that was him. The Son of God movie, that was him. Ben-Hur recently, that was him. They also did like AD, which was a follow-up to the Bible miniseries. So that's all the stuff he's done. And it's really fascinating because he says, in Hollywood, there's so few Christians, like there's virtually none. And so he's viewed as a bit of a crackpot. I mean, he's spending his own money, like tens of millions of dollars, to get these movies financed. He's probably one of the only people who can do it. Can you imagine with that track record? You know, four hit shows, and The Voice is like one of the number one shows now. You know, it's quite fascinating. He's got a lot of influence in Hollywood. He's one of the only Christian voices there, and he's driving through these Christian programs. And he made this great comment. When people talk to him, like they have to because of his influence in Hollywood, he says, when they talk to me, I always mention Christ and talk about Christianity. They don't have a choice but to listen to me. I want to be a noisy Christian. So, but his passion was phenomenal. And when he came up and spoke at the conference, people said they were surprised at actually how passionate he was. Like this wasn't like, oh yeah, I think I made those shows. I'll just make some good stuff. You know, like it's a business proposition. I mean, he was like very emotional, and that's like his driving thing. And he made this comment, I want to do something significant with my life. So can you imagine a guy with all the money anyone could possibly want? And he grew up in very poor circumstances, you know, came to the U.S. with no money, you know, had this massive success. And yet he said, all that success was worthless. I wanted to do something significant with my life. So the key thing is, so P1, the passion. So again, get back to what is your passion? Now, secondly, if you have the passion, that should start to form what would the purpose be? What are the things that you can focus on that are rooted in your passion? Now, this guy here is a really interesting example. Anybody have the YouVersion Bible app on their phone? Okay, so the YouVersion Bible app has been downloaded 250 million times. Why? Because of this guy, Bobby Gruenewald. It's a fascinating story. I'll just recount it briefly because it gives a really great example of how somebody pursues their calling and can have an impact. So Bobby Gruenewald is a successful high-tech entrepreneur. And he's in Oklahoma City. And so he's done well in the high-tech field. He started a few small companies, sold them, made some money. So he thinks, okay, I've done that. That's good. But you know what? I'm now in Oklahoma looking at a new church. I'm going to go to this place called Life Church, which at that time was not very large. So he goes to Life Church and he thinks, okay, you know, I'm not bad at music. You know, I'm sort of okay. And he calls himself a rapper. He says, you know, he's white, obviously. He says, I'm a very bad white rapper. White guys cannot rap, but I love rapping. I'm really bad at it, but that's what I love doing. And I love music, but I'm not really any good at it. So he goes to the church. So here's a guy with all this high-tech skill. He goes to the church and he's just thinking, okay, my business stuff, that's not for church. I got to do something that we do in church. Like we play music. We worship. We do that type of stuff. So he's playing in the band up there. Probably not very good. There's a guy who's the executive pastor of the church. He's a former executive from Target. So does everybody know Target? You know, like a Walmart, this huge department store chain. So he's the executive pastor. So he's sitting there in the pew and he sees this guy up there playing music. He goes, that looks like the guy that I saw in the paper the other day. So he remembered reading an article in the Oklahoma paper that said, Bobby Gruenewald, high-tech entrepreneur, sells company, makes X amount of dollars. So he's thinking, what's that guy up there doing playing music? So he contacts Bobby. He says, okay, look, let's get together. And Bobby Gruenewald describes all this stuff in such a comical way. He says, we get together, and the pastor says, look, why are you playing music? You're not that good at it. Well, let's just call a spade. Like, you're not that good. Okay, we admire your enthusiasm, but you're not that good. But he says, but I see that you've got this high-tech background. So maybe there's a way we can use your high-tech skills to try to use them in the church somehow. He's like, well, I guess so. Like how? See, and I want to stop there because that's how a lot of people think. So let's say you've got all these skills that are developed in the marketplace, and you might have skills that people pay a lot of money for. So why not bring those skills into the church and see how those skills can be utilized here? So Bobby Gruenewald meets this guy and he says, look, you got this high-tech background. Why don't we sort of figure out something to do with the church? Our purpose of the church is to get out the gospel, the message, to as many people as possible, not just throughout Oklahoma, but throughout the world. Okay, great. Maybe we can do that through technology. Now, this is a few years back, so they think, okay, let's do a website. All right, so we'll do a website. We'll have Bible passages up there. We'll have all sorts of stuff in the Bible. So they think this is a great idea. So the church actually spends the money on it. And then what happens is, he says, the website was an absolute complete flop. He says, I would tell you the name, but none of you would know the name because nobody came to it. So it was a disaster. So he's thinking, okay, so before we bury this thing, let's just see if there's anything else we can do. So they go, you know what? There's and Bobby Grunewald made this comment. He said, not even I go to my own website. That's how bad it is. He says, because what do? Well, I walk around with my phone. I want to get things on my phone. Now, of course, this sounds like ancient history. Like, we're only talking about 10 years ago. Now, there used to be something. Now, most of you may not have heard of this, but there used to be something called a BlackBerry. Anybody ever remember? It's sad. Great Canadian success story, now a great Canadian non-success story. Anyways, he said, I tried to think, how can I get this thing on my BlackBerry? And he thought, you know what? BlackBerry sort of falls ring, but, you know, there's this guy, Steve Jobs, and he's got this thing called, like an iPhone. And there's these, you know, this sounds like ancient history, and there's these things called, like, apps. Maybe we could put that as an app. So he actually contacted Apple and was one of the first 200 apps on the iPhone. One of the first 200. And so they get this app on there, and what happened is the first 3 days, it was downloaded 80,000 times. So it just went like through the roof. Anyways, so from there, they start to develop this. And, you know, right now, like when we had them speak in Toronto a year and a half ago, we were saying, okay, it's been downloaded 175 million times. Okay, if you just Google like YouVersion Bible app, it's now been downloaded like 250 million times. There's this ticker, it just keeps going on and on and on. So it's quite fascinating. We look at the purpose. So Bobby Grunewald has this calling. He has these gifts. He has this unique track record and talent. And then he matches with this church and helps the church build this YouVersion Bible app. You know what? The YouVersion Bible app, it's actually owned by Life Church. It's actually owned by the church, if you can believe it. But Bobby Grunewald is the guy behind it. So, you know, fascinating story. And the one last point I'll mention is, when you think in terms of calling, have you ever thought you think too small for God? Like, have you ever thought, and this is a really interesting spiritual concept. So have you ever thought that what you conceive that you can do, you're thinking too small? Just imagine. Whatever you're thinking now in terms of what you can accomplish, what God can accomplish through you, you're thinking way too small. You go, well, you know, I'll just give you one personal example, and then I'll give you an example from Bobby Grunewald. So I do these entrepreneurial leader conferences. And we've done 30 of them in Vancouver, Toronto, Winnipeg, and other places, Hong Kong, Shanghai. Anyways, and I remember thinking years ago, who would be, sorry, this thing, you can still hear me, or? Yeah, perfect. So I thought, who is the biggest Christian guy I could possibly get who could speak at our conference? Like, who do you think is the best known Christian business person, like trainer, leader, expert in the world? Like, it's John Maxwell. So John Maxwell is a former pastor. He has sold 26 million books. 26 million books. He's been ranked the number one person in the world. He turns down over 100 speaking engagements for a year, and he normally gets $125,000 for one day. And you can't even get a hold, like, if you thought, hey, I'll just contact John, see how he's doing these days. Good luck. Like, you would go to info@JohnMaxwell, and you'd never probably hear anything back. So I remember thinking years ago when I was doing these conferences, oh, if I could ever get him. And another person I thought of, Stephen Green. Now, Stephen Green, when you have 300,000 employees, now he's a member of the House of Lords, I checked online, his salary was $1 million a week base. So he doesn't need a lot of money. He's probably pretty busy. He's probably doing just fine. I thought, if I could ever get him, that would be phenomenal. But I just sort of written it off. Anyways, fast forward. So there's a guy who's a client of mine, and it turns out he knows John Maxwell. He hires John Maxwell two or three times a year to come up to Vancouver to work with his company. So this client, his company's went up 20 times in 6 years. So it's going like this. He hires John Maxwell just to come up, just to meet with his company. So I start talking to him, and I say, do you think there's any chance I could maybe get John Maxwell? He goes, well, you know what? John Maxwell's going to be in town in January. I want you to come to the reception. So I meet John Maxwell there, and I sort of plant this thing in his ear. We've got this nonprofit. This is what we're doing. It'd be great if you came up, blah, blah. And, you know, a guy like John Maxwell, like, well, you know, thanks very much. And, you know, sort of like, thanks, and yeah, we'll get back to you like never and just keep moving. And, you know, okay, I mean, all you can do is ask, right? And then I talked to my client again. He goes, well, maybe just send a letter to his, you know, his key guy. I send an email to the key guy. We go back and forth. Then they go, okay, we'll do it. And I was like, okay, maybe we're missing one part here. Like ELO is a nonprofit. Like, okay, you'll do it. But the shoe will drop when I go, but we don't actually have 125,000 US. Just, you know, so when I got that email, I phoned the person back. We scheduled this call, and I said, don't want to ask a stupid question, but just to confirm, were you going to do it for free? Yeah. And then whenever this stuff happens, I'm thinking, okay, I cannot believe this. Now, when you organize an event, you're always really, really skeptical that the person's actually going to show up. Like, I actually thought, to the very last minute, he was not going to show up. I actually believe that. And, you know, the same thing with Mark Burnett. Like, when Mark Burnett said he'd come, you know, this is why when I organize events, people look at me and go, they feel sorry for me. They go, better you than me. I'm glad there's people like you who organize these things so I can just show up and enjoy it. Because with Mark Burnett, what happened was he was going to come the day before. So I had stuff scheduled the Tuesday night. He was going to come in the afternoon the Tuesday. We have a thing on Tuesday night. Wednesday morning, he'd come to the conference all day, be the big keynote in the evening. Okay, great. And him and Roma Downey were both going to come. And then a few weeks before, oh, Roma Downey had something come up with one of the kids. She can't come. Okay, well, I got half of it still going on. So, okay, Mark Burnett will carry the day. Okay, great. He's coming Tuesday. The day before, no, can't come Tuesday. I'm going to come Wednesday morning. Okay. The conference starts. We have our reception Tuesday night. The conference starts first thing in the morning on Wednesday. I was going to interview him Wednesday afternoon. The big keynote in the evening. He's going to come Wednesday morning. I think it was going to be like around 11 o'clock. Then I get another email that morning. He's going to come around 3 o'clock. Okay. I'm thinking, okay, like this is cutting it just a little close. Because, I mean, you know, flights do get delayed and blah, blah, blah. So then I was going to interview him at 4 o'clock for the afternoon group. So anyways, he ended up showing up literally at like 5 to 4. He literally showed up like 5 to 4. I basically said hi to him, walked out on stage, and we had the 4 o'clock interview. And then he did the keynote. And I was thinking like, oh, I can't believe it. So with John Maxwell, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, fortunately, he did show up. It was all good. But then the second thing is, so that was John Maxwell. And then with Stephen Green, I had tried to get a hold of Stephen Green a few years before. Could never get a hold of him. And I always thought, oh, this guy, the Wall Street Journal described him as in a universe of one. Can you imagine somebody describe, I mean, if somebody described me that way, it would not be for good reasons, right? But for Stephen Green, a universe of one. There is no other person in the world like this guy. He's run one of the biggest banks in the world. He's also a minister. He writes books. He's a member of the household, the whole bit. I could never get a hold of him. I got sort of bad email addresses. And then I meet this German guy about a year ago. And I was talking to him. He goes, yeah, we just had Stephen out last week. And I'm like, whoa, I don't know if you ever had this happen. I go, like, whoa, let's stop here. Sorry. That's Stephen Green? Like, Lord Stephen Green? Yeah, sure, I know him. I'm thinking, you know, whenever somebody says, it's like, if you want to get a hold of, let's say, Barack Obama, just let me know. I'll just give him a call. Oh, really? Yeah, sure, you're. Oh, you know, he's too busy for it. But yeah, we're really tight. So you get a little skeptical in business, right? So anyway, so this guy says he knows Stephen Green. So being in Germany, he goes, okay, send me a letter. I will send the letter, sort of this formal letter to him. So the letter goes to Stephen Green. A week later, I've got his email address, and I'm talking to him on the phone. And I thought, this is like 5 years in the making. So all that to say, can we think too small? So Bobby Grunewald, he said, to his shame, what do you think that when they started that YouVersion Bible app, what do you think in his mind he ever would have thought that could have achieved? He said, we thought, man, if we could get 100,000 people to download this thing, that would be phenomenal. And he was just coming off a website that failed. So now this YouVersion Bible app, 250 million downloads. So it's a really interesting spiritual lesson. but we pursue our calling, do we actually think too small? And just think of the impact you can have. Now, John Maxwell describes it this way. He calls it the God room. There's what we think we can do. There's what God can accomplish. That gap is the God room. That's where God works. God does more than we could humanly imagine we could do. That's the power of calling. So, passion, purpose, priorities. Now, this fellow, and I'll be done by in 5 minutes. This fellow is like really fascinating. Lord Edmiston. We like to have lords. So, you know, it's fun. We call him Good Lord, Praise the Lord. So we have Lord Robert Edmiston. We had Lord Stephen Green. So this fellow started with nothing, built it up. He's worth $1 billion. So this billionaire was our speaker a couple years ago. The most humble, genuine guy. He said, you know, I've achieved way beyond what I ever could have imagined. He's in the process of giving away 300 million pounds. So about 500 million Canadian. He started a charity called Christian Vision, doing stuff all over the world. And it's really fascinating because he says, I've always been aware of my own mortality. I often thought on my deathbed, am I going to think about the last $1 million I've made or that person in the prison who's dying of AIDS in Mozambique who I spoke to and became a Christian? So it's really interesting. Despite him, you know, being a billionaire, and I've had the honor and the privilege of meeting a lot of these extraordinarily high profile, extraordinarily successful Christian business individuals. And you know what? Almost all, I'd say all the ones I met, they have such a sense of humility. Like Mark Burnett, my wife Brenda and I, we were with him the very last person to leave the room. He stood there and talked to everybody. Like literally, they were rolling up the tables, putting away the chairs. There was nobody left except my wife and I and Mark Burnett. And he said, I never want anybody to say I didn't have time for them. Like he has a blue collar background. Like his dad worked at the Ford Motor Company in London. Like he had nothing. Very, very humble. This guy, Lord, he said, just call me Bob. So we called him Lord Bob. You know, he still is British, right? So not just Bob, it was Lord Bob. But just like such a genuinely humble guy, so focused on having a ministry impact. So passion, purpose, priorities. Now, anybody want to guess what the bonus P is? It starts with a P, of course. What's that? I couldn't hear that. Oh, people. That's a good one. Prayer? Oh, P. Philemon? Is that? Paulman. I like Philemon. Paulman. Paulman. It's Paulman. The fourth P is Paulman. Yes. Power. Paulman power. It's actually Paulman power prayer. It's all of it put together. I'll just get them to change it at the back. Okay. Persistence. You know, this quote is so, like this is one of the companies or one of the people, one of the groups I've interviewed. It was so fascinating. They have, I don't know if they still have it, but they had this business called the Chapel. So they had the Stanley Park Chapel and a few other chapels. And they're like small business operators. And his name is Alan Burnett. When everyone is telling me to throw in the towel, I want to be like Rocky in the 15th round. His face looks like it's been through the meat grinder, yet he gets up and wins. Without that sense of calling, I would not be able to get up off the mat. So think of calling as that overpowering and compelling vision that drives you forward. So making a difference, and this is what we'll talk about as we go through the action plan, but here's just a few thoughts. So we talked about meaning at work, different models, and the Christian idea of we have meaning and work fits in that. We talked about the notion of calling, the importance of calling, passion, purpose, priorities. We looked at the examples of, you know, Mark Burnett, Bobby Grunewald, Lord Edmiston. So how do you make a difference in the marketplace? So calling involves your whole life. So your faith has to impact what happens in the marketplace. So a few things are my calling applied to work, not just what I do outside of work. You know, things like excellence. You know, a lot of Christian business people say the best thing you can do as a Christian is to be excellent at what you do. I love that verse and that concept. You know, he who is diligent will stand before kings. You don't have a very good testimony if you're a crappy employee. You ever think of that? That's actually sad. And a lot of Christian business people say when they hire people from the church, they think they get a free pass. They can work less hard because, my boss is Christian. He won't do anything. So why not commit to being excellent at what you do? Building relationships. Just think of it this way. How many people do you come across in the work arena? Like your sphere of influence, depending on what you do, how many clients you have, how many customers, how many stakeholders. Like if you thought of it, you might come across 10, 20, 50 people in your circle that you can influence. And we know, how do people come to faith? The biggest reason is because they have relationships with people who take an interest in them and then invite them to church and connect with them. That's how it happens. So just think, when you're in work, at work, you have the capacity to influence so many people in sharing faith responsibly. You know, in our society, people are always sort of prickly about talking about faith. Well, I found it, when you talk about what gives you meaning, it's a very different conversation. If you say, you know, are you a Christian, or you lead with something very specific, it can turn people off. But I've never met anybody, if you start talking about, well, what's, you know, if you said to somebody, so what gives you meaning? Most people are happy to talk about that. Well, this is what gives me meaning. So think of it in that context. And then dealing with hypocrisy. You know, it's really interesting because a lot of business people, they're, in a sense, demobilized because they don't want to be called a hypocrite. Like sometimes I say, if I haven't been called a hypocrite in the last month, I'm not doing my job. Because why are you called a hypocrite? Because people know what you stand for. And it's really interesting. It's usually non-Christians who think they have a better idea of what Christians stand for than Christians themselves. But you know what most business people do? They think, I don't want to be called a hypocrite, so what do? Keep their nose clean, their head down, and they don't stand for anything. That's a sad thing. Because that's a very protective mechanism, right? But if you're out there like, hey, here's what I believe in. Oh, well, I saw this thing in the paper about Christians and, you know, and okay, yeah, okay, I can take the flack. Let's talk about it. But how do you avoid that? You keep your head down, your nose clean, and you don't actually tell anybody what you're about. So your sense of calling impacts the workplace a lot. So just to close, in terms of making a difference. So here's a couple of verses that I think, just to think about. I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling to which you are called. So just think, we all have a calling. Isn't it a big obligation to think, I need to walk worthy of that to which I've been called? You know, at the end, you'll be asked, what have you done with what you've been given? Are you a good and faithful steward or not? You know, just think, are you not walking worthy of that to which you've been called? Not what other people have been called to, but what you've been called to. See, again, calling is subjective. It's your calling, not somebody else's. With this in mind, we constantly pray for you that our God may count you worthy of his calling and that by his power he may fulfill every good purpose of yours and every act prompted by your faith. So that's a great verse for calling. So there's just the three P's. I'll just end with this quote. Now, Charles Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers in Victorian England, you know, he's got, you know, if you want to read the collected works of Charles Spurgeon, I think there are about 700 volumes. I think every word he ever uttered is actually recorded. But anyways, he's got one great quote here. Let each man, each person, find out what God wants him to do and then let him do it or die in the attempt. That's a pretty powerful statement. But how are we motivated? You know, that find out what God wants you to do and then do it or die trying. So on that encouraging note, as we talk about your mortality and, you know, morbid topic as it is, where what we'll do now is it's a little about quarter after 10. We'll take a 10-minute break, just a chance to get some coffee, get yourself juiced up. And then we have a calling action plan. So we've got these sheets that will be at the tables, and it'll be a chance to work through what your calling is. So we'll do that for around half an hour, and then you'll talk at your table. And after that, we'll have a group session where we'll pass around the mic, and we'll find out what people at each table ended up, you know, coming up with. So we'll take about a 10-minute, maximum. So let's say at 10:30 we'll start again. So 10 minutes. Thanks.